Welcome to our deep dive into Weimar Germany.
Yeah.
Today we're going to be exploring
It's a good one.
The fascinating and unsettling period between World War I and the rise of the Nazi Party.
Right.
We've got a history chapter and some primary source documents.
Well, very cool
Like
part.
personal diaries and speeches
Wow.
to give us both the big picture and a feel for what people were experiencing at the time.
It's a really crucial period to understand,
Yeah.
not only for 20th century history,
Right.
but also because it holds some eerily relevant lessons for the world today.
I agree.
The sources you've provided offer an especially good look at just how complex things were.
Yeah.
It wasn't a straight line from WWI to Hitler.
Right. There's this common idea that the Nazis just inevitably took power. But there were moments of hope, political maneuvering, and a whole bunch of economic factors that played a role.
Definitely.
To unpack all that we need to start by setting the scene.
Okay.
It's 1918. Germany's just lost World War I. The Kaiser, their emperor, has abdicated, and the country is in shambles. Imagine the feeling of defeat, the demoralization,
It's hard to even comprehend.
people trying to make sense of how everything fell apart.
It was out of this chaos that the Weimar Republic was born,
Oh,
a
wow.
brand new, fragile democracy trying to rebuild a nation from the ashes of an empire.
It's interesting because on the surface, this new republic seemed to have a decent plan. Did they just try to copy other democracies?
Well, they aimed for a truly democratic system.
Okay.
The Weimar Constitution included things like universal suffrage, so everyone could vote.
Wow,
A
everybody.
president elected for a 7-year term,
Okay.
a chancellor to lead the government, and a parliament with two houses,
Oh, wow, two houses.
the Reichstag and Reichsrat.
Okay.
Think of the Reichstag as the main legislative body, kind of like a House of Representatives,
Got it.
and the Reichsrat representing the different German states, similar to a Senate.
Okay, like a federal system.
Yes, exactly.
Sounds like a pretty standard setup for a democracy.
On paper, it seemed promising.
So where did things go wrong?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
It is.
One major issue was Article 48 of the Constitution.
Okay, Article 48, what did that do?
This article gave the president emergency powers to make decisions without the parliament's consent.
Oh, so they could just bypass the parliament?
It was intended for extreme situations,
Okay.
but in practice, it ended up being used to push through unpopular policies
Yeah.
and ultimately undermine the legitimacy of the Reichstag.
So even in their attempt to create a democracy, they accidentally built in a way to bypass it. Kind of ironic, right?
Exactly. It's like installing a self-destruct button in your system.
Wow, yeah.
And don't forget, we're talking about a nation dealing with the trauma of a devastating defeat.
Right.
The stab in the back myth was gaining traction at this time.
The stab in the back.
The idea that Germany didn't really lose on the battlefield,
Right.
but was betrayed by politicians and civilians back home.
I can see how people would grasp at that explanation.
Right.
It's easier to blame a shadowy enemy within than to accept defeat.
Right. And it was a lie, a
Risk.
powerful and enduring lie, but it fueled resentment,
Oh, wow.
extreme nationalism, and a yearning for someone to make Germany great again.
It's like history repeating itself.
This kind of thinking is ripe for exploitation by groups like the Nazis.
So they come in and say, we're the ones. We're
Exactly.
the ones who can fix it.
They prey on those feelings of resentment and anger.
And then on top of all that, you have the Treaty of Versailles, which must have felt like adding insult to injury.
Imagine being forced to accept blame for a war,
Oh, wow.
giving up huge chunks of your land, and
Right.
paying crippling debts that cripple your economy.
It's like they lost everything.
That was the reality for Germans under the Treaty of Versailles.
Wow.
Germany was forced to accept harsh terms, loss of territory, crippling war reparations,
Crazy.
payments for the damage caused by the war. And the infamous war guilt clause that placed the blame for the entire conflict squarely on their shoulders.
Like it was all their fault.
No wonder they felt betrayed and humiliated.
And I bet that humiliation only made the stab in the back myth even more believable.
Absolutely.
It's like they needed someone to blame.
The economic impact of the treaty was devastating.
Yeah.
It led to economic instability and hyperinflation so severe that people needed wheelbarrows full of cash to buy a loaf of bread.
Wheelbarrows of cash for a loaf of bread.
It sounds
That's
crazy.
insane.
It was a surreal and desperate time. People saw their life savings evaporate overnight.
Oh my
Just
God.
imagine the social unrest that created.
Yeah. I can only imagine.
And this is where the appeal of extremist groups, groups like the early Nazis, began to take root.
So they capitalized on this.
They offered simple solutions to complex problems.
Right. Make Germany great again.
Exactly. They promised to restore order and prosperity.
So at this point, we've got political instability, economic chaos, and a population that's vulnerable to radical ideas.
It was a breeding ground for extremism.
It seems like almost the perfect breeding ground for extremism.
It was a dangerous mix.
But you mentioned that the Nazi Party started out as a tiny group.
Yeah.
It's hard to believe they were anything but powerful.
It's almost hard to believe considering what they became.
I know, right? From this tiny little group to...
They started as this fringe group.
Yeah.
The German Workers' Party meeting in beer halls.
In beer halls.
Can you imagine that?
It's like something out of a movie.
Right.
So how did they go from beer halls to becoming one of the most notorious political parties in history?
Well, a young charismatic leader named Adolf Hitler joined the party in 1919.
Oh, Hitler, the future dictator.
Yes.
Wow.
He had a talent for captivating audiences with his fiery speeches, blaming Germany's problems on Jews and communists.
So he was a powerful speaker.
He was mesmerizing to some.
Yeah.
He also formed the SA, the Brown Shirts, as a paramilitary force to intimidate opponents.
So violence and scapegoating were part of their strategy from the very beginning.
Exactly.
And they used these brown shirts to
silence dissent.
Yeah, to silence any opposition.
And in 1923, they even tried to seize power in the infamous Munich Putsch.
Oh, the Munich Putsch. I've heard of that.
A failed coup that landed Hitler in prison.
A failed coup.
It was a disaster for them at the time.
That's a pretty big setback.
It was, but it also proved to be a turning point.
A turning point? How so?
During his time in prison, Hitler wrote Mein Kampf.
Mein Kampf.
Which lays out his twisted ideology.
Oh, so that's where it came from.
His belief in Aryan supremacy, his hatred of Jews, and his vision for German expansion.
Wow, so Mein Kampf was like a blueprint for the Nazi Party.
You got it.
It's terrifying to think about that that book was like their guiding principle.
It's a chilling read, but essential to understanding the Nazi mindset.
Yeah, I can imagine.
After his release, Hitler realized that brute force wasn't enough.
So he learned from that mistake.
He needed to gain power through the existing system, as flawed as it was.
So he decided to play the long game.
Exactly.
Wow, that's...
He adopted a strategy of exploiting the very democracy he intended to destroy.
That's incredible.
And what happened next gave him the perfect opportunity.
What was that?
The Great Depression.
Ah, yes. The Wall Street crash of 1929.
1929, the year the world changed.
I remember reading about that in school.
It was a global catastrophe.
It wasn't just an American problem, right?
Right. It had ripple effects all over the world.
Yeah.
The global economic crisis hit Germany especially hard because their recovery was heavily reliant on loans from the United States.
They were depending on those loans.
When the U.S. economy crashed, those loans dried up.
Oh, so they were cut off.
Unemployment in Germany skyrocketed, creating widespread despair.
Oh, wow.
And making those radical solutions offered by the Nazis all the more appealing.
It's tragic how something that happened across the ocean could have such a huge impact on Germany.
It shows how interconnected the world is.
Yeah.
And how vulnerable even seemingly strong nations can be to global forces.
And I bet the Nazis were able to capitalize on that, right?
You're absolutely right.
Like, look. We told you this would happen.
They pointed the finger at the Weimar government.
Yeah.
And said, see, this is what happens when you trust these weak politicians.
They really knew how to exploit the situation.
This was when we see the Nazis, who had been a relatively marginal group, begin their meteoric rise.
Okay, so let's dig into how they managed to do that.
Let's do it.
We know that Hitler was a charismatic leader.
Yes, a master manipulator.
And that he was using propaganda and violence.
Those were his tools.
But were there other factors that contributed to their success?
Yes, several.
Okay.
We need to understand the political landscape in Germany at that time.
Okay, the political landscape.
The early years of the Weimar Republic saw uprisings from both the political left and right.
Oh, really? From both sides?
Which demonstrated just how fragile the new government was.
Wow.
For example, there was the Spartacist uprising, a communist revolt led by Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht, which was brutally suppressed by the government.
So even though the Weimar Republic was trying to establish democracy, there were groups that wanted to overthrow it.
Exactly. They saw the Weimar Republic as weak and illegitimate.
So they were coming at it from different angles.
And on the right, we had the Cap Putsch, an attempted coup by nationalist groups, including members of the Freikorps.
The Freikorps, who are they?
Think of them as paramilitary groups made up of disgruntled war veterans.
Okay, so former soldiers.
They were disillusioned with the government and yearned for the glory days of the German Empire.
Right, they wanted to go back to the old ways.
They become a breeding ground for the violence and anti-democratic sentiment that would later be embraced by the Nazi Party.
So it's like all these different factors, the economic crisis, political instability, and the rise of extremist groups were creating a perfect storm for the Nazi Party to rise to power.
It was a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, it's like everything was lining up perfectly for them.
And they were ready to take advantage of it.
But there was a brief period when things in Germany seemed to improve, right?
There was. It was a period, brief but significant, often referred to as the Golden Age of Weimar, when things seemed to stabilize.
The Golden Age of Weimar.
This was largely due to the leadership of Gustav Stresemann.
Stresemann, tell me more about him.
He was a remarkable figure.
What made his approach so successful during such a turbulent time?
Well, Stresemann was a skilled politician who served as both chancellor and foreign minister.
Wow. So he held two major positions.
Imagine having to balance domestic problems with international relations during a period of such immense global tension.
It was a lot on his plate.
It was no easy task.
Yeah.
He managed to negotiate more favorable agreements with the Allies, like the Dawes Plan, which restructured Germany's war reparations.
So he was trying to ease the burden of the Treaty of Versailles.
And the Locarno Pact, which eased tensions with France and Belgium.
So he was trying to improve relations with other European countries?
He understood that Germany couldn't recover in isolation.
That makes sense.
So he was trying to rebuild trust and cooperation.
So he was a shrewd diplomat who understood that cooperation, not just confrontation, was key to getting Germany back on its feet.
Exactly.
And did he achieve anything?
He achieved some remarkable successes.
Really? Like what?
Germany's industrial output doubled during this time.
Wow. It's impressive.
There was a sense of renewal culturally and economically.
So things were actually looking up.
People started to believe that democracy might actually have a chance.
It's almost heartbreaking to think that this glimmer of hope is going to be extinguished.
It's a tragedy.
What went wrong?
Unfortunately, the Wall Street crash of 1929 dealt a fatal blow to Stresemann's efforts and to the Weimar Republic as a whole.
Ah, so we're back to the Great Depression again.
It was a global crisis that had far-reaching consequences.
And I can already see how this is going to play into the hands of extremist groups like the Nazis.
It was a gift to them.
Yeah.
They were waiting for an opportunity to exploit a crisis.
And this was the perfect crisis.
It was a perfect storm.
It's amazing and scary to think that the seeds of this horrific regime were planted during a time of such hardship and uncertainty.
It's a reminder that history is full of twists and turns.
Yeah.
And even during moments of great despair, there are individuals who, like Stresemann, strive to create a better future.
Yeah, he sounds like a really interesting guy.
But as we'll see, those efforts can be undone by events that are completely outside of their control.
It's like fate had other plans.
Sometimes it feels that way.
This has been fascinating so far. But where do we go from here?
Well, we've set the stage.
Right.
We've seen how fragile the Weimar Republic was.
Yeah.
How vulnerable it was to both internal and external pressures.
Okay.
Now we need to dive deeper into how the Nazis exploited those vulnerabilities to seize power.
I want to understand how they went from being a fringe group to gaining actual political power.
That's where things get really interesting.
Yeah, because they had a plan.
They were strategic and ruthless.
And they were willing to do whatever it took to achieve their goals.
And the world would never be the same.
So we're about to enter some dark territory.
Buckle up.
But it's important to understand how these things happen if we want to prevent them from happening again.
Absolutely. We can't let history repeat itself.
We left off with the Nazi Party gaining momentum during the Great Depression.
Yeah.
But it wasn't just economic hardship that they exploited.
Right.
I'm curious about the role of religion during this period.
Okay.
Both the Catholic and Protestant churches were pretty influential in German society back then, right?
You're right. Religion played a complex and often surprising role in this story.
Yeah.
On the one hand, many Christians, particularly Protestants, were initially drawn to the Nazi Party's anti-communist stance.
That makes sense. After the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, there was a lot of fear about communism spreading across Europe.
Exactly. Hitler was very savvy in exploiting this fear.
Yeah.
Presenting himself and the Nazi Party as a bulwark against what he called the Red Menace.
Right. Like, we're the only ones who can stop it.
But Hitler's ultimate goal was to subordinate religion to Nazi ideology.
To Nazi ideology.
He wanted to create a kind of Nazified Christianity.
A Nazified Christianity. That's interesting.
Something that served his purposes.
Okay, so how did he try to make that happen?
He started by trying to control the Protestant churches.
The Protestant churches.
In 1934, the Nazis established the Reichswehr.
A Reichswehr.
An attempt to unify the various Protestant denominations under a single state-controlled church.
So basically, a church that would answer to the Nazi state,
mm-hmm.
not to any sort of higher religious authority.
Precisely. It was a pretty blatant attempt to co-opt religion for political purposes.
Wow. So they were really trying to take control.
They even went so far as to demand the removal of traditional Christian symbols from churches.
No way, really.
There was even talk of replacing the Bible with Mein Kampf.
Wow, that's shocking. I can't imagine that went over well with everyone.
You're right. It sparked a backlash.
Yeah.
Many Protestants saw this as a direct attack on their faith.
Right, like you're trying to change our religion.
This resistance led to the formation of the Confessional Church.
The Confessional Church.
Uh-huh. Okay. A movement within Protestantism led by figures like Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Martin Niemöller.
I know Bonhoeffer's name. Wasn't he the theologian who was executed for his involvement in the plot to assassinate Hitler?
Yes. He was a truly remarkable figure.
Yeah.
He saw the inherent evil of the Nazi regime and refused to compromise his faith.
Wow.
Even when it put his life in danger.
So he was willing to die for his beliefs.
He was.
Well, incredible.
The Confessional Church, though a minority, was a vocal group that directly challenged the Nazis' attempt to distort and control Christianity.
That's incredibly brave.
Yeah.
They were basically saying, no, you can't twist our faith to fit your ideology.
Mm-hmm.
So they stood up to the Nazi party.
They did, and they paid a heavy price for their resistance.
Yeah.
Many members were arrested, and some, like Bonhoeffer, were sent to concentration camps.
So they were persecuted for their beliefs.
They were.
It's inspiring to think about their courage in the face of such oppression.
It's a testament to the power of faith and conscience.
But what about the Catholic Church?
Ah, yes, the Catholic Church.
They were a much bigger and more organized religious institution.
Much bigger.
How did they deal with the Nazis?
The Catholic Church was a more formidable opponent.
Okay.
It's a transnational institution, meaning it operates across national borders.
Oh, I see.
And it has a long history of resisting state control.
So they weren't going to be easily intimidated.
Not at all.
So how did Hitler deal with them?
Hitler, being a shrewd politician, initially tried to appease the Vatican by signing a concordat in 1933.
What is that exactly?
It was basically a treaty between the Nazi government and the Vatican.
Okay.
The center of the Catholic Church.
Okay.
In this concordat, the Nazis promised to respect the Catholic Church's autonomy within Germany.
So they promised to leave them alone.
In exchange for the church staying out of politics.
Hmm. Sounds a little bit like a deal with the devil.
Perhaps.
I can't imagine Hitler keeping his end of the bargain for very long.
You're right to be skeptical. Hitler had no intention of honoring the agreement in the long run.
Right, because he wanted control over everything.
He saw the Catholic Church, like any organized group outside of his control, as a potential rival.
So he saw them as a threat?
And he gradually began to undermine its influence.
How so?
Closing Catholic schools, harassing priests, and suppressing Catholic youth groups.
So much for religious freedom.
It was a gradual process of erosion.
Yeah.
But it was clear that the Nazis were not going to tolerate any challenge to their authority.
How did the Vatican respond to these provocations?
They eventually condemned the Nazi regime's actions.
Right.
Most notably in Pope Pius XI's 1937 encyclical, Mit Brennender Sorge.
Wait, Brennender Sorge.
This document, written in German, denounced the Nazi violations of the Concordat.
So they called them out.
And their totalitarian ideology in very clear terms.
So the Pope was calling out Hitler directly. That's a weird move.
It was, and it showed that even within the Catholic Church, there were those who recognized the danger of the Nazi regime and were willing to speak out against it.
And were there any Catholics in Germany who resisted?
Yes. There were courageous Catholic leaders like Bishop August von Galen who publicly challenged the Nazis' euthanasia program.
Oh, wow. The euthanasia program.
A horrific program that targeted people with disabilities.
That's right. I remember learning about that.
The Nazis labeled people with disabilities as unworthy of life.
It's terrifying how they twisted medical language to justify their horrific acts.
It's a chilling example of how ideology can be used to dehumanize and justify violence.
And it wasn't just people with disabilities.
No.
They targeted other groups as well.
It's a chilling reminder that the Nazis' obsession with racial purity extended far beyond their hatred of Jews.
Right.
They had a warped worldview that sought to eliminate anyone they deemed unfit for their vision of a master race.
It's hard to grasp the level of cruelty and dehumanization that fueled those policies. Yeah. But let's go back to the Nazis' persecution of Jews.
Okay.
We all know about the Holocaust, but I'd like to understand how it all began. How did anti-Semitism, something that had existed in Europe for centuries,
right,
become a central part of Nazi ideology and policy?
Well, you have to understand that for the Nazis, anti-Semitism wasn't just a prejudice.
Okay.
It was a core part of their ideology.
Like it was fundamental to their beliefs.
They believed that Jews were not just different,
okay,
but were racially inferior and posed an existential threat to the German nation.
So they saw them as a threat to their very existence.
This idea was fueled by centuries-old stereotypes and conspiracy theories,
right,
that portrayed Jews as greedy, untrustworthy, and disloyal.
So they took existing prejudices and amplified them to a whole new level.
Exactly, and they used the full power of the state to enforce their racist agenda.
So it wasn't just words, it was actions.
It began with systematic discrimination and exclusion.
Okay.
Jews were barred from holding public office, their businesses were boycotted, and they were subjected to a constant barrage of propaganda that dehumanized them.
So they were systematically stripped of their rights and their place in society.
They were being pushed to the margins.
It's horrifying how quickly a government can turn against its own citizens.
It's a reminder of how fragile civil liberties can be.
Yeah, especially in times of crisis.
And how important it is to have strong institutions that protect those liberties.
What were some of the specific laws or policies the Nazis implemented against Jews?
Well, one of the most significant was the Nuremberg Laws of 1935.
The Nuremberg Laws weren't those the laws that stripped Jews of their citizenship.
That's right.
Wow.
These laws stripped Jews of their German citizenship, forbade them from marrying or having relationships with non-Jews.
So they were trying to isolate them.
And essentially classified them as second-class citizens, subject to all sorts of restrictions and abuses.
It's unbelievable that such laws could be enacted in a supposedly civilized country.
It's a dark chapter in human history.
It's a reminder that even in a democracy, the legal system can be used to oppress and dehumanize entire groups of people.
The law can be a powerful tool for both good and evil.
And the Nazi regime was very effective in manipulating the legal system to achieve its goals.
They were masters of legal manipulation.
And this campaign of hate and discrimination culminated in Kristallnacht, also known as the Night of Broken Glass, in 1938.
Kristallnacht, a night of terror.
It was a night of terror where synagogues were burned, Jewish businesses were destroyed, and thousands of Jews were arrested and sent to concentration camps, right?
You're exactly right. It was a pogrom, a state-sanctioned attack on a particular group.
A pogrom?
In this case, Jews.
Okay, so the state was directly involved in this violence.
It was orchestrated from the top down.
Wow.
It was a turning point, a clear sign that the persecution of Jews was escalating to a new level of violence and brutality.
And all of this happened within just a few years of Hitler coming to power. It's chilling to think about how quickly a society can descend into barbarity.
It's a reminder that the veneer of civilization is thin.
When fear, hate, and unchecked power are allowed to flourish.
Those are the ingredients for tyranny.
And it's important to remember that Kristallnacht wasn't just about physical destruction.
Right.
It was also about humiliation. It was about breaking the spirit of the Jewish community.
It was a psychological attack as much as a physical one.
And it served as a warning to anyone who might dare to oppose the Nazi regime.
Don't step out of line.
It's a stark reminder of the human capacity for cruelty and the dangers of silence in the face of injustice.
We must never forget the lessons of Kristallnacht.
But before we move on to the horrors of the Holocaust,
okay,
I think it's important to understand the economic context in which all of this was happening.
Yes, the economics of the Nazi regime are crucial to understanding their rise and their ability to wage war.
How did the Nazis manage to pull Germany out of the Great Depression?
That's a complicated question.
How did they fuel their war machine?
That's a fascinating and complex question, one that reveals a lot about the inner workings of the Nazi state.
Okay.
It's a story of economic manipulation, social engineering, and ultimately a system built on exploitation and plunder.
I'm ready to dive into that.
Mm-hmm.
I think Understanding the economics of the Nazi regime is crucial to understanding how they were able to consolidate power and carry out their horrific agenda.
Let's explore how they did it in the final part of our deep dive.
We've been unpacking the rise of the Nazi Party, and it's been a pretty heavy journey so far. We've seen how they exploited political instability, manipulated religion, and systematically persecuted Jews. But we haven't really talked about how they actually ran the country.
Right.
Especially the economy. I mean, they came to power during the Great Depression, right?
Yeah.
How did they manage to turn things around and build up their war machine?
Well, it's a fascinating story.
Yeah.
One that reveals a lot about how totalitarian regimes function.
Okay.
It's a combination of clever, albeit unethical, economic policies.
Okay.
Brutal social engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And a whole lot of propaganda.
Propaganda.
Remember, the Nazis inherited an economy in shambles.
Right. It was a mess.
Millions were unemployed and people had lost faith in the system.
Yeah, they needed some kind of hope.
Hitler knew that to consolidate power, he needed to deliver on his promises of economic revival.
So what did he do? Did he just print more money?
Well,
I know that didn't work out so well during the hyperinflation period we talked about earlier.
He actually did something quite different.
Okay, what did he do?
He understood that people needed jobs. They needed to see tangible results.
Yeah.
So the Nazis launched this massive program of public works projects.
Public works projects.
Think of it like a giant government-funded construction boom.
Okay.
They built roads, bridges, dams,
right,
and all sorts of infrastructure projects.
That sounds a bit like FDR's New Deal in the United States.
Yeah.
Was it a similar idea?
There are some surface similarities, yes.
Okay.
Both involved government spending to stimulate the economy and create jobs.
Right.
But there's a dark side to the Nazi approach.
Okay, and dark side.
A lot of their economic recovery was tied to rearmament.
Rearmament.
They were secretly building up their military, which violated the Treaty of Versailles.
Right, they weren't supposed to be doing that.
But it created jobs in industries like steel and manufacturing.
So they were essentially preparing for war,
yeah,
while simultaneously addressing unemployment.
Yeah, it was a calculated risk.
That's pretty cunning in a twisted kind of way.
They were playing a dangerous game, but they managed to spin it as a positive thing.
Right. Make Germany strong again.
They presented it as a way to restore Germany's pride and strength.
I bet propaganda played a big role in selling that narrative to the public.
Absolutely. The Nazis were masters of propaganda.
Yeah.
They portrayed hard work and sacrifice as patriotic duties essential for the revitalization of Germany.
Well, everyone has to do their part.
They even created the Reich Labor Service, which conscripted young men into working on these public projects.
Conscripted, wasn't that basically forced labor?
It was, but they presented it as a national service, a way to build character and instill discipline.
Oh, wow.
They also manipulated the labor market to create the illusion of full employment.
Okay, how did they do that?
For example, they encouraged women to stay home and focus on raising children,
okay,
which freed up jobs for men.
So it wasn't just about building roads and bridges. They were reshaping German society to fit their ideology.
Exactly. They wanted to create a Volksgemeinschaft, a people's community, based on racial purity and national unity.
And to achieve this, they needed to control every aspect of life, including the economy.
They had a vision for a new Germany.
But their economic miracle came at a steep price.
It did.
What do you mean?
Well, their policies were unsustainable in the long run.
Okay.
They were essentially running a deficit-fueled economy, borrowing heavily to finance their programs.
So they were spending money they didn't have.
And they were increasingly reliant on forced labor and the exploitation of conquered territories.
So it was all built on a foundation of sand, as they say.
Yeah, it was the House of Cards.
It looks impressive on the surface, but it can't last forever.
And let's not forget about the most horrific aspect of their economic policies.
Yeah.
The systematic plunder of Jewish businesses and assets.
Right.
After stripping Jews of their rights, they seized their property, their bank accounts, their businesses.
So they were stealing from them.
This provided a huge influx of wealth for the Nazi state.
It's sickening to think that they were funding their economic policies through theft and violence.
It was a morally bankrupt system.
It's a stark reminder that the Nazi regime was fundamentally corrupt and immoral.
Yeah.
Their economic policies might have produced some short-term gains.
Right.
But they were ultimately built on a foundation of exploitation, racism, and violence.
It was a poison chalice.
It's been a truly eye-opening deep dive. We've seen how a confluence of factors, economic crisis, political instability, and a masterful use of propaganda allowed the Nazi Party to rise to power.
And the world paid a terrible price.
And transformed Germany into a totalitarian state. It's a chilling reminder of how fragile democracy can be.
Yeah, we can't take it for granted.
And how easily it can be manipulated by those who crave power.
Power corrupts.
You know, it's easy to look back and say, oh, we would never let something like that happen again. But the seeds of hatred and intolerance still exist today.
They do. It's up to us to be vigilant.
That's why it's so important to be vigilant.
To speak out against injustice.
To speak out against injustice and to defend democratic values.
The lessons of the Weimar Republic are more relevant than ever.
Well said. This deep dive has been both fascinating and deeply disturbing. But ultimately, I think it's a story that needs to be told and retold. Thank you for joining us on this journey. We'll have some resources in the show notes for those who want to explore this topic further.
Yeah, there's so much more to learn.
And as always, stay curious, stay informed, and stay engaged.